Welcome to Conversations on Healthcare with Mark Maselli and Margaret Flinter, a show where we speak to the top thought leaders in health innovation, health policy, care delivery, and the great minds who are shaping the healthcare of the future. This week, Mark and Margaret speak with Dr. David Nash, founding dean of the Jefferson College of Population Health at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia. He's a renowned expert in the growing discipline of population health, which seeks to empower primary care through better pay incentives for clinicians and leadership training that focuses on team-based care delivery, all to do a better job of preventing illness across populations. Lori Robertson also checks in, the managing editor of FactCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain, separating the fake from the facts. And we end with a bright idea that's improving health and well-being in everyday lives. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you listen to podcasts. And you can also hear us by asking Alexa to play the program Conversations on Healthcare. Now, stay tuned for our interview with Dr. David Nash on Conversations on Healthcare.
We're speaking today with Dr. David Nash, internist and founding dean of the Jefferson College of Population Health. Dr. Nash serves as principal faculty member for quality of care programming at the American Association of Physician Leadership and serves on the National Quality Task Force on Improving Population Health. He's a distinguished fellow of the American College of Physician Executives and frequently named to Modern Healthcare's list of the most powerful persons in healthcare. He earned his MD at the University of Rochester, his MBA from Wharton School of UPenn, and completed his fellowship at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Clinical Scholars at the University of Pennsylvania. Dr. Nash, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Yeah. You've been engaged in this work for a while. Well, I think some people say you're the Dean of Population Health. And I'm wondering if you could just share with our listeners your definition of population health and why is it so essential to improving health outcomes across the country?
Sure. So Thomas Jefferson University now has 10 colleges. We're the youngest of the 10 colleges that make up Thomas Jefferson University. And in less than 5 years, the entire university will celebrate its 200th birthday. So when I came to Jefferson 30 years ago as an assistant professor of medicine, I spent 18 years on the campus of the medical school, first as the director of the Office of Health Policy, and then in 2003 as the chairman of a medical school department. We modeled that Department of Health Policy after Mark Chasson's first such department at Mount Sinai Medical School. Right. And of course, Mark is now the president of the Joint Commission. Yep. And then in 2008, the Board of Trustees of the university voted to create the College of Population Health, and we opened the doors on September 9th, 2009, so 9909. So last summer was our 10th birthday. So population health, I think we like to give credit to Dr. David Kindig, our colleague, in his 2003 paper, 16 years ago. David called for an understanding beyond public health and labeled it population health, that basically said, hey, public health is wonderful, but it's too narrow. And population health takes into account, are we delivering the care in a cost-effective and safe manner? So here's our summary. Population health is the roof of the house, and the house is supported by various pillars, central pillar being public health, and then health economics, quality and safety, and health policy. So we're the first such college of its kind. There are now more than a dozen colleges of population health in the country. Pretty incredible, rapid diffusion, I would say, into higher education.
Well, that's great. One of the things that I note about the Affordable Care Act is that it's done so many great things.
Indeed.
20 million Americans are covered by it. 30 million more Americans still need to get that coverage. And
right.
But there have been other benefits of the Affordable Care Act in addition to access. Walk us through the intersection of how the Affordable Care Act has helped building this community of people who are focused in on population health.
Wow. Well, you know, so as Speaker Pelosi so aptly put it, we'll figure Obamacare out after we pass it. We're still working on it. But I think you hit the central take-home message. The central message is, of course, roughly 20 million American citizens now have access to health insurance, therefore access to primary care and beyond. As best as we could tell, research from very good people, Ashish Jha, Atul Gawande, and others, that the bill has saved lives. And I think we could all agree to that. But to your question, the bill has also created the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. It created accountable care organizations. It created, in effect, bundled payment. It created the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. And so, look, we're well on the journey, I think. Most citizens who look at the evidence would agree that Obamacare is a major step in the right direction. From a population health perspective, certainly when we got board approval in 2008, we never could have dreamt that less than 2 years later, the nation would adopt Obamacare, which was sort of a rocket ship, if you would, to blast off the better understanding, acceptance, and diffusion, all of the above, of population health. And I think Obamacare recognizes that let's try to reduce waste, let's try to reduce error, let's try to standardize care. If we reduce waste, that's good for everybody. Let's try to expand coverage. I mean, it's doing all these things at the same time. But look, we're making progress, and I think it's central to our mission to promote universal coverage and universal access.
So, you know, Dr. Nash, we've spent a lot of time, I think, since the passage of the Affordable Care Act, looking at our healthcare system. But when we look at the rest of the world, how we do on health outcomes, maybe still leaving quite a bit to be desired. If you look at those comparisons, almost always you find out that there's a bigger investment upfront in primary care. And they're also talking about an investment in some of the social determinants of health. Maybe share some examples, if you can, what countries are really executing on this idea of getting the highest value care and through a focus on primary care and population health.
Sure. Well, we are the only developed nation in the Western world, of course, with the upside down and backwards ratio. Here's what I mean. In most of the Western world, all of whom have better outcomes at a lower cost than us, there are typically three primary care doctors for every specialist. Mm-hmm. And of course, in the United States, three specialists for every primary care doctor. Countries that have primary care at the very center of the system have better outcomes, have less waste, and are much safer. We're not in the top 10 of any measure of health outcome, despite spending, you know, 1.5 times our nearest rival, roughly $10,000 per person in 2018. So I ask everyone, do you believe your family got $10,000 of value out of the healthcare system for every single member of your family in 2018? I've yet to have someone say, oh yes, it's been a great bargain. So the entire civilized Western world as we know it achieves far more with fewer dollars than we do. And one of the key attributes that they all share is the emphasis on primary care. How many more papers do we need that says primary care is the answer?
Well, we think a lot about that here in our organization, about the shortage of primary care clinicians. There are solutions. Certainly, we have a 50-year history of nurse practitioners educated and prepared to be primary care providers, but too often still not recognized as primary care providers. So that's a big focus. Certainly, telehealth, including telemedicine, is going to make a big difference for patients and maybe solve some of the geographic and the transportation and the rural maldistribution issues that we have. And of course, there's the holy grail of making our electronic health records more interoperable, more friendly. Take any of those emerging trends and how are
Yes, good. How will it all help? Yeah. Well, you know, so let's start with medical school education. So I've been inside the belly of the beast for 30 years. I've mentored, I mean, literally 1,000 medical students, because Jefferson Medical College is so large. I'm so proud that I have a daughter who's now an attending physician.
Congratulations.
So, you know, Paul Bataldon said it right, Margaret. Every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results it gets, right? Yeah. So if medical students see that the ologist has all the prestige, they will want to become an ologist. And when they see the prestige, when they see the income, the implicit culture that rewards the specialist in the training environment. So step one, change the training environment. So two, financially reward primary care. In part, let's do loan repayment, less of an inequality between super subspecialist income and primary care income. I won't give away the store here, but in the faculty practice plan, average annual total salary X and 15X. So, you know who the X is and you know who the 15X is. Well, to me, that's unconscionable. And we need to do way more to promote folks who are at the primary care X level. Next step is to let folks work to the top of their license. You know, regrettably, in my travels to this day, it is not unusual for me to have a physician come up to me face to face to say, there's no such thing as physician leadership. We could do a lot more to teach physicians to be the team quarterback, and primary care could all be about a big team sport. Every one of these steps, medical school, residency training, loan forgiveness, teamwork, all of that is a major cultural shift, but we have to start someplace to really implement this kind of dramatic change in making primary care and care coordination the center of who we are and what we do. Finally, of course, change the payment model. You guys are experts in this. So we know that especially primary care doctors will make dramatic changes in their clinical behavior for modest increases in marginal income. That's a fancy way of saying, if you pay primary care doctors in the right direction, they will change direction. I'm all in favor of a bundled payment for congestive heart failure as a really great example, putting care coordination, primary care doctors, and our cardiology colleagues in the center and paying us to go upstream. Let's go upstream and shut that faucet instead of mopping up that floor. That's the best visual that I think explains this.
We couldn't agree with you more. We're speaking today with Dr. David Nash, internist and founding dean of the Jefferson College of Population Health. Dr. Nash is not only an expert in population health, but is also active, as he noted, in leadership development in healthcare. And we just had on a little while ago your CEO at Jefferson Health, Dr. Steve Klasko, and talking about his vision for health industry leadership for the 21st century. And he says it's a model built to support team-based care. And Margaret, we've had our good friends who we've worked with, Dr. Ed Wagner and Dr. Tom Bodenheimer, as part of our efforts at the Weizmann Institute, working on sort of designing that. And, you know, that really, you did note it was a team so that everyone in that team can practice up to the top of their license. We've been engaged in training from medical assistants to nurse practitioners. And I know that every member wants to have an equal voice in there. What are some of the other strategies that you're developing for leadership? Because there are so many players. It takes an entire team to work with a patient. You know, in particular with population health, where so much of the intervention is outside of our four walls. What are you doing to cultivate this opportunity?
Let me give you two specific examples, and perhaps Dr. Klasko talked about one of them. So Steve created the Jefferson Onboard Leadership Training, or JOLT, J-O-L-T, and everything here has to start with a J. So in the previous 25 years that I was here, there was no leadership training program. It was sort of absurd. So JOLT takes emerging leaders from across our enterprise now, 16 hospitals, 10 colleges, brings them together every month for a year to give them leadership training, skill building, communication skills, quality improvement skills, and all the rest. So major step in the right direction. A program that we created, we worked hard and got the Board of Trustees in 2014 to mandate that every clinical department in the medical school must train at least one faculty member to be an expert in quality and safety. And we've now subsequently dubbed this QIPS, Q-I-P-S, and our college is now running and implementing QIPS for the enterprise. We have every month, once a month for a year, working with a hand-picked group who will have a certificate in quality and safety as another example of training emerging leaders. So JOLT and QIPS, two steps in the right direction. We still have a long way to go. If it were up to me, Mark, I would have every medical student, you know, read Peter Drucker and John Cotter and all the rest, because that's what makes organizations great and enduring.
We're very focused on training the next generation, and certainly leadership being really quite expert in safety and performance improvement. The ability to lead a team is something we expect of everybody who is an emerging leader in the organization.
Wow. Well, to your credit.
Mm-hmm. But one of our approaches is that it really has to be interprofessional training. Otherwise, train people in a silo,
yep,
which recreates the other silos that we have, and then you get a tremendous amount of headbutting. Everybody has the potential to be a leader of the team,
yes,
or the practice or the corporate organization or the school. Tell me what your experience is and what you're learning about really training leaders in an interdisciplinary, yeah, interprofessional way. Passing, to use your quarterback analogy, and I always use the wrong ones when I talk sports, to be able to pass that leadership role kind of back and forth among people, or to have,
right,
different people taking those roles. I know the folks out in Minnesota have been doing a lot with this, but we'd love,
yes,
to hear what your experience is at,
great,
Jefferson.
So we share space on this floor in this building with probably one of the nation's top five centers for interprofessional education called JCIPE, Jefferson Center for Interprofessional Education. It has a physician and pharmacist co-executive director. They've done a huge amount of work. I'm a fan, but I also am a healthy skeptic. And here's why: the trainees, medical students, nursing students, pharmacy students, are very rarely in the same room together.
Huh.
And that is a huge challenge. It's because of accreditation and other issues. So yes, I'm well aware of the progress in Minnesota and elsewhere. I think JCIPE is certainly a peer. On the other hand, are we collectively in the classroom, mm-hmm, really working in an early stage together? Very, very modestly. Interprofessional education, certainly important step in the right direction. Mm-hmm. More importantly, I think, is at the bedside. How does the team function? Is there equity in the, you know, the views? Are there pharmacists embedded with the house officers? Are the nurse practitioners called upon? I think there are baby steps everybody could take that would go a long way to improving this. But this is an uphill battle. Again, it's all about the culture.
Yeah.
When you come and you make rounds in a place like ours, no different than the other 150 academic medical centers, it's pretty clear who's who and who's in charge.
Mm-hmm.
If we could improve upon the leadership training so, yeah, everybody feels like they're participating, and it's, yeah, pretty clear that we're better together than we are individually,
mm-hmm,
you know, that'll be a big step. For physicians, anyway, everybody wants to be a quarterback. Can you imagine a football team of all quarterbacks? Well, that would be a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, we don't have to practice because we're all expert. You know, that doesn't win a football game.
Yeah. You've got your work cut out for you.
You've got your work cut out for you.
Well, and Dr. Nash, speaking of uphill battles, I want to sort of connect two points that you made. One of the difficulty of shifting culture, and the other for our country to promote more value-based care. I think these are difficult ones. We had the opportunity, Margaret, the other day to have Leah Binder from,
right,
LeapFrog,
absolutely,
really just talking about the, I think the good news was that there had been a slight reduction of the number of preventable deaths,
yep,
in hospitals, but it was still up at 160,000. It was still 500 people a day.
Right.
It still had me asking myself the question, if five airplanes were falling out of the sky every day, would anybody show up at the airport? So talk about how we're going to make this shift. And you were saying earlier, they need to giddy up in terms of moving us more to value-based care. But
so look, I wonder if our listeners know, right in the same building where I'm sitting is the dean in charge of the physician assistant training programs. Do you appreciate that training in quality and safety is mandatory for physician's assistants?
Mm-hmm.
If the public knew that no such mandatory rule exists in medical education,
that's shocking.
Do you think their reaction would be?
I'm not sure I knew that.
Right. And imagine if you were the chancellor of the University of North Carolina and you woke up last week and you saw that front page New York Times story doctors feeling so compelled that they surreptitiously recorded the meeting of the quality committee because they were so concerned of what was happening to those children in that open heart surgery program.
Shameful.
It's 2019. Let's get on with it. And so I have been for 30 years unwavering in total transparency as it relates to outcomes and error reporting. Total transparency. We wrote about this in JAMA in September of 1991. So, you know, I'm very disappointed. This is one of my biggest shortcomings, I guess. We haven't moved this ball as far down the field as I would like. And then to see a headline like that, there but by the grace of God, we all go, imagine being at UNC. Oh, and how about Jacksonville Children's Hospital just 2 months ago? And how about a major hospital in Texas? We could go down the list. And so, but you know, again, Paul Batalden, every system is perfectly designed to achieve the results it gets.
Right.
You know, what do you want to take out of the curriculum? That's what most medical educators ask me. You know, here's the barge of medical education. It's weighted down. Should we throw out the heart? And then we could put in quality. You know, this is what I get asked all the time.
And that conversation goes on in all sorts
in every
of
place.
Disciplines.
So,
you,
look,
you know, I think the
systems training, that's what we need.
Yep. Harkening back to Mark's comments about Leah Binder, you know, I think that show sent a lot of people back to looking at their states.
You
Not
bet.
Sure most people realize, but when you know that your own state is rated for safety, and you can compare hospitals, people start asking a different set of questions, and people, I think, want their hospital to be successful. They want to know their community hospital is the best. They want everybody to have an A rating and are certainly willing to put their support behind
exactly.
it. So thank you for
highlighting that. I can't help but remember, we're coming up the August 14th, 1991 issue of JAMA, our team here in Philadelphia, and our colleagues at Dartmouth, the two lead papers. A little known Harvard pediatrician wrote the editorial.
We know
Don
Berwick. Yeah, Don. Exactly.
And Don said to admit that you could do a better job as an expert makes you vulnerable.
Right. Quote, to err is human.
Right.
Absolutely.
So we're publishing a special issue to speaking of that. Thanks for reminding me, Margaret, of our journal, the American Journal of Medical Quality, come September of 2019. We're going to have a 20th anniversary issue.
Perfect.
And we went back and we looked at the top articles in our journal in the last two decades, the most cited, the most referenced. It's fascinating to see. So on a good day, I feel like we have made some progress with lots of help, of course, with famous people like the ones on your program. And then there are days I think, you know, University of North Carolina, what's it all about?
We've been speaking today with Dr. David Nash, internist and founding dean of the Jefferson College of Population Health. You can learn more about his work by going to jefferson.edu/population health or follow him on Twitter at @NashPopHealth. Dr. Nash, we want to thank you for your groundbreaking work
thank
in advancing population health, celebrating the big wins and the incremental improvements, and for joining us today on Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
The measles outbreak in the United States and around the world has sparked misinformation on social media. One false Facebook meme blamed illegal immigration from South America, but the virus was eliminated across both North and South America in 2016. The recent outbreak is due largely to inadequate vaccination rates in some communities. Measles was eliminated in the United States in 2000 and, as mentioned, from the entire North America and South America continents 6 years later. Elimination means cases can still occur, but that the disease hasn't been continuously spread for a year or more. Recently, the virus has been brought into the U.S. by people who have traveled to places where there is an outbreak or where the disease is still common, such as parts of Europe, Africa, Asia, and the Pacific. From those travelers, the disease can then spread in U.S. communities that have unvaccinated people. The Pan American Health Organization said the measles outbreak in New York City, which started in 2018 and spread in the Orthodox Jewish community, was brought on by travelers who had been in Israel, where a large outbreak is occurring. The New York City Health Department declared a public health emergency on April 9th. The CDC has said this year marks the largest number of measles cases since the disease was eliminated in the U.S., and it said misinformation about vaccines was, quote, a significant factor contributing to the outbreak. Similarly, the executive director of UNICEF and the director general of the World Health Organization issued a joint statement that cited online misinformation about vaccine safety as a contributing factor in the rising number of measles cases in high and middle income countries. Some major social platforms have recently taken steps to curb this spread of misinformation. Facebook announced in March that it would reduce the visibility of vaccine misinformation, and YouTube said in February that it would prevent users who promote vaccine misinformation from running ads. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Asthma is one of the leading causes of trips to the emergency room for children, and there are often a correlation between high-density, low-income neighborhoods and more trips to the hospital for treatment and intervention. When officials at Boston Children's Hospital noticed a spike in asthma outbreaks in certain neighborhood clusters, they decided to do something about it. They launched the Community Asthma Initiative. They realized that if you could treat the environments in the patient's home, that might reduce the need to treat the patient in the emergency room.
The home visiting efforts work with children and families that have been identified through their hospitalizations and emergency room visits as an identification of having poorly controlled asthma, and also it's a teachable moment.
Dr. Elizabeth Wood heads the program and says the first step is to identify the frequent flyers, those kids who make repeated trips to the emergency room. Then they match with the community health worker who visits their home several times and assesses the home for asthma triggers.
And they work on three areas: understanding asthma itself, understanding the medications and the need for control medications, and then working on the environmental issues.
Families are given everything from HEPA filter vacuum cleaners to air purifiers. They are told not to clean with certain toxic products, and the homes are monitored for the presence of pests or rodents. The result, says Dr. Wood, has been pretty dramatic.
What's remarkable is that there was a 56% reduction in patients with any emergency department visits and 80% reduction in patients with any hospitalization.
And while this program is expensive, there is a return on investment in reduced hospital costs and healthier children. The program has been so successful, it's being deployed in other hospital communities around the country. The Community Asthma Initiative,
a simple reshifting of resources aimed at removing the cause of disease outbreaks in the community, leading to healthier patient populations. Now that's a bright idea.
You've been listening to Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare is recorded at WESU, at Wesleyan University, streaming live at chcradio.com, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you. The show is brought to you by the Community Health Center.